All right, we are going to be continuing in our First and Second Samuel series, I believe. Maybe. There we go. And we are talking about this return to the king. By way of review, if you have not been with us for the first part of this series, here's what we've seen so far. Judges, the book that comes just before this, was a march to the bottom. Everything that Israel could have done wrong, they did wrong. And things got worse and worse and worse. But in the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, God is going to reverse that trend, and he's going to use this man named Samuel to do it. He's already been doing that as we moved along, but he called this young man from the point that he was a child, raised him up, and Samuel is serving as God's voice in the nation of Israel to direct them back to their true king, God, which we just sang about. We just sang about, behold our God, who is risen to reign. The fact that God is the one that we should want as our king, and we are seeing that through this book of 1 and 2 Samuel, that God is the one that Israel should have wanted reigning over them. But instead, they decided they wanted an earthly king, a king that they could see with their eyes, a king who would rule over them. And God warned them through Samuel that this is not a good idea. This is a bad idea. If you put a king in place over you, the king is going to take. That is the only thing. He is not going to give. He is not going to prosper you. He is going to take from you, and he's going to take from you, and he's going to take from you. And Scott did a great job of laying that out for us the week he preached. But they decided, you know what? We still want what we want. We still want to do things our way. And Audrey laid out the decision they made to eat the pepper. Even though they had been warned it was spicy, even though they were told it was going to cause them pain, this was going to be a bad decision. They decided, give us the king anyway. We want the king. And God let them have the king that they wanted. And that king came into power. His name is Saul. And in spite of this bad decision, in spite of them calling a king and turning from the God as their king to a human king, God still gave them this promise through Samuel that in spite of their bad decision, in spite of the things that they have done, he is still not going to forsake them, that they will still be his people. He will still love them. He will still be there for them. And he is not going to forsake them. But that doesn't mean they're going to be safe from the consequences of all their actions. And we're going to see some of those start to come today. If you have not been around here long, I just need to tell you a little something before we jump into today's passages. When I plan out my sermon series, I typically do that in about September, and I tend to plan them out about a year in advance. I say this because sometimes we hit passages and people think, oh, Pastor Kyle must be mad at me because he's preaching this because he knows what happened in my life this week. No, I promise you, I am not hiding behind your couch. I don't know what happened in your life this week unless you told me. I chose this over a year ago. If I'm mad at anybody, it's me, because there are things that I hit in these passages, and today is absolutely one of them that I'm like, man, that was a dumb decision. Why did I make the same exact one this week? That is not, if anything, I am preaching to myself. I am not preaching at you. God might be, but that has nothing, like, that's between you and him, not you and me. But there are parts of this passage today that as I was prepping, I was like, man, that person's dumb, like me. Like, I do these same things. So if you're feeling that this morning, know that that was not my intention. Again, it might be God's, but it's not me. I don't think you're dumb. Let's jump in. We're going to cover a lot today, two chapters, and because I've really been enjoying some of the patterns that we get to see because we're taking larger chunks of Scripture in one bite. But that also means that, again, if you're following along line by line in your Bible, you're going to hit points where you're like, he just skipped a section. Yes, I did. It was on purpose. It is not to hide things. I highly encourage you to go read those passages anyway. I highly encourage you to read all of it, because all of it is in there for a reason. We just don't have time to cover all of it today. So I pick the things that are a little more prominent, the things that are a little more important to the overarching story that the author is trying to tell. If at any point you are reading along and you're like, he missed this and this was very important, and I need to go tell him how important this is, great. I really enjoy beverages. I would love to go out and get a beverage with you, whether that's coffee or tea or Diet Mountain Dew, or and we can make that happen. Let me know, and you can tell me why you think it's important, and I'll tell you, you're right. It is important because it's in the Bible. Everything in the Bible is important. It may just not have been important to the point we were chasing this morning. Cool. All the disclaimers out of the way. Let's jump in. Samuel, 1 Samuel chapter 13, verse 1 starts like this. And Saul lived for 1 year and then became king. And when he reigned for 2 years over Israel, Saul chose 3,000 men of Israel. 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash and the hill country of Bethel. And 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin. And the rest of the people he sent home, every man to his tent. Let's hit the confusing one first. Saul was not 1 year old when he became king. It says Saul lived for 1 year and then became king, and when he had reigned for 2 years over Israel, everything we talked about today happened. This is an incredibly confusing thing that people have been debating for generations. Why does it say that he lived for 1 year and became king? First, back in 1611, when they were translating the King James, they did not have the Dead Sea Scrolls. And at that point in time, these numbers were just completely missing. They just weren't there in the manuscripts that we had at the time. So the people who were translating the King James guessed. It wasn't just a complete and total guess. It was a deductive guess based on the other histories that we have through 1 and 2 Chronicles, 1 and 2 Kings, other background that we have in Scripture. But they filled in the blanks to the best of their knowledge with these numbers. Later on, as we discovered more manuscripts, it actually ended up confirming some of their logic around it. And what the actual phrase here is, Saul as the son of 1 year. So it's a phrase or a euphemism that they stuck in here that they then had to translate not just the language barrier, but also the cultural barrier as to what does a son of 1 year mean. And what they're saying here is that there is this period of time between when Samuel, the author and main character in the story, said, you are going to be king. From the time that he was anointed king to the time that he became and was coronated as king was about 1 year. And then this story is taking place 2 years after that. So 3 years total from the time he was anointed to what we're going to be reading today. That's what this confusing sentence at the beginning of this chapter means. I only bring that up because if you go online, you might find, see, this is a contradiction in Scripture. It's not. It's very easily explained. As soon as we had more copies of the manuscript, it made it clear that the things that we had deduced and figured out from the context were actually right. If they hadn't been, we would have fixed it. But we were right all along, which is great. So anyway, at this point, 3 years after his anointing as king, 2 years after his coronation as king, Saul is winning. He is defeating the Philistines. He is having victory. So at this point, while he is at Michmash in the hill country of Bethel, he decides, the rest of the people that we have, we had this massive army. I got 2,000 here with me. My son Jonathan's got 1,000 with him. That's enough. We can send the rest home. They can all go home to their tents, and they can hang out. I don't need such a massive army anymore. If you remember, he had called them in the previous chapters on a threat of violence, that he was going to come and kill all their oxen and really make them regret not showing up. Now that he's been winning, he's like, I don't need such a big army. We're going to send them home. This is not the start of. We've kind of seen it cropping up throughout his life, but it is another example in Saul's life of what one of his greatest flaws is going to end up being. Saul is a prideful man. And he is someone who really thinks it's all about him. And that truth, that thinking that it's all about him, is really going to come in and bite him today in some pretty serious ways. And so Jonathan defeated the garrison of the Philistines that was at Geba. And the Philistines heard of it. And Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, let the Hebrews hear. And all Israel heard it, said that Saul had defeated the garrison of the Philistines, and also that Israel had become a stench to the Philistines. And the people were called out to join Saul at Gilgal. So what's going on here is Jonathan's son, who has the 1,000 troops, is going out, and he's going to do battle with this garrison of Philistines at Geba. And when he does, he experiences victory, because that is what is happening in the life of Israel right now. They are having victory. And Jonathan leads his men, and he defeats the Philistines. Let me say it again. Jonathan leads his men, and he defeats the Philistines. Saul blows the trumpet throughout the land, saying, "Let all the Hebrews hear." And what the Hebrews hear when he blows the trumpet, because he's the one going around blowing the trumpet, and because his men are the ones going around blowing the trumpets, they go, "Oh, Saul has defeated the garrison of the Philistines." Saul didn't beat the garrison of the Philistines. Saul is absolutely taking credit for what his son did, but Saul didn't defeat the garrison of the Philistines. Jonathan did. And at this point in the story, you're probably saying to yourself, "Well, yeah, but Saul's the king. Saul's the one in charge. So, of course, he would get the credit for what his men did." I'm telling you, as we move forward in this story, you're going to see this is not a one-time occurrence. Saul thinks it's all about him. Jonathan, though, was the one going and doing the work. And the Philistines mustered to fight with Israel 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen and troops like the sand on the seashore in multitude. And they came up and they encamped in Michmash to the east of Beth Aven. Saul now gets to eat his words. Because Saul went and told everybody, "Look how awesome I am. Look, we defeated the garrison of the Philistines." He blows the trumpet all over the place. And the people of Israel hear him blowing the trumpet. And they're like, "Man, this Saul's pretty good. He's really whooping on those Philistines. He's really the one he's just really great warrior. He's awesome." And the Philistines hear it, and they go, "Excuse me, now what? He's really, really talking bad about us over there. Should we bring the rest of the army? Let's bring the rest of the army up and see what happens." And they have 30,000 chariots. That is not a small amount of chariots. This is an army on the move, and they are here to do business. On top of that, as if that wasn't enough, 6,000 horsemen and troops like the sand on the seashore in multitude. This is the Bible's way of saying too many to count. There are so many, you cannot count them. That's how many troops they showed up with. They are here to do war. And when the men of Israel saw that they were in trouble, because they are in trouble, for the people were hard-pressed, the people hid themselves in caves and in holes and in rocks and in tombs and in cisterns. And some Hebrews crossed the fields of Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead, and Saul was still at Gilgal. And all the people followed him, trembling. All of a sudden, doesn't look like Saul's winning all that much anymore. And all of a sudden, the people are terrified because this massive army shows up. So they hide. And I love the places it tells you you hide. It starts off like, yeah, of course, caves, holes, rocks, yes. Tombs and cisterns. Yeah, gross is the right answer to that. Tombs is already gross because that's like dead people. Cisterns, that, I don't know if you've ever had your septic tank pumped, but think if when you pull that lid off and you're like, "Yeah, that looks like a good place to hide," and you jumped in. That is how scared these people are. This is where they are hiding. Some of them, though, crossed the fords of the Jordan and to the land of Gad and Gilead. If you remember Gad and Gilead from our discussion of Joshua, which was actually 2 years ago, this is the land on the other side of the Jordan. They didn't enter the promised land with the rest of Israel. They stayed behind. Well, actually, they did go to war with them, but they received the land on the other side of the Jordan as their reward for going to war with them. When the Philistines took over, this is the first places that they conquered. This is Philistine land. So when it says that they cross the fords and they go to Gad and Gilead, they're turning to the other side. They're saying, I think we're going to go live with the Philistines and pretend to be Philistines. We don't want anybody to know that we're Israelites. And they go and they basically join up with the enemy because they have decided God must not be with Saul anymore. We're going to abandon ship. This is where Saul is. So quickly, after sending everybody home, he is now confronted with nobody thinks we're going to win anymore. So So he waits the 7 days, the time appointed by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. So Saul said, "Bring the burnt offerings here to me and the peace offering." And he offered the burnt offering. At first glance, you're like, this doesn't really seem all that significant. Why are we camping here on verse 8 and 9? This is extremely significant, because what is going on is Samuel has told Saul, "I am going to come. We will give our offerings to God before we go into battle, so that God will go into battle with us, so that God will deliver the day." But who is the voice in Israel for God in Israel right now? Samuel. Who is responsible for giving offerings in the land of Israel? Samuel. The priests, those who are given the task all the way back in Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy. These are the ones who give the offerings in Israel, not the leaders. The priests, the ones who speak for God. They are the only ones who are allowed to give these burnt offerings. The king should not be doing this. But the king looks at the situation and says, people are going to run away. People are going to be scared. And I need my army to defeat the enemy. I need my army to defeat the enemy. Therefore, I need to do this thing so that they won't be scared, so that they won't run. So he goes ahead and offers the burnt offering. This was Saul thinking he needed the army more than he needed God. This is Saul thinking, if I don't offer these, I'll lose the army. If I lose the army, I'm going to lose the battle. Having completely forgotten that this is a God who defeats 120,000 with 300. God didn't need his army. God didn't even need Saul. God needed obedience. And as soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him and greet him. And Samuel said, "What have you done?" I'm adding that exasperation for effect. But the idea here is, when he gets there and sees what Saul has done, it is not good for anybody. I love the way that the writer, probably Samuel, puts this. As soon as he'd finished, it may sound like Saul's sitting there, he's offered the offering, they're burning. He turns around and then Samuel's like, "Hey, what's going on?" Like, he's just been hiding behind him the whole time. But he's like, "What have you done, bro? Like, that's not okay." And Saul says, "Well, when I saw that the people were scattering from me, and that you did not come within the days appointed, and that the Philistines had mustered at Michmash, I said, well, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the favor of the Lord. So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering." He's saying, he's like, "Look, I thought we were going to lose this battle, and God can't lose a battle. So I wanted to go fight for him. I was doing the right thing. I wanted to go fight for him. But I knew I needed to pray first. I knew I needed the favor of the Lord. I knew I needed God. So I didn't want to do it. I really didn't want to do it, but I forced myself to do it anyway. And I offered the burnt offering." It already told us why he offered the burnt offering. He was scared. He was losing his people. He wanted the people more than he wanted his God. But he gives this excuse of, "I forced myself. I made myself do it because, yeah, I was scared," is the truth. And Samuel says to Saul, "You have done foolishly. You have not kept the command of the Lord your God with which he commanded you. For then the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever." He's like, Samuel says to Saul, "Saul, if you had just obeyed, if you had just done what God had called you to do, if you had led in such a way that God had called you to lead, the commands of your God, he would have established your kingdom forever. You would have had nothing to be afraid of. But you couldn't do that." And it's really easy for me to get on Saul here, because Saul had clear instruction from God, this is the thing you should do. And he said, "Well, this is the thing I think I need to do, and the thing I think I need to do must be more important than the thing that God has called me to do in this situation, so I'm going to do the thing I think I need to do." And man, what a boneheaded move. But don't I do that all the time? I look at the thing that I think I need to do for God. I look at the thing that I think, well, this must be important to God because it's important to me. And in order to get this done, I know God has commanded me to do this thing over here, but because I think I need to get this done, I'm just going to ignore this for a little bit so I can get this done more efficiently, so I can get this done better. I'm just going to ignore that thing doesn't matter. I'm going to do this thing because I think it's important. How often does God look at me and go, yeah, but I commanded you to do this. You think you need to do that. How about we start with what I command you to do? Then we'll worry about this other thing over here. Because Samuel tells Saul, because if you'd just done this, the thing that he commanded you to do, you and your house would have been kings forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. For the Lord has sought out a man after his own heart. This is a phrase that's going to establish itself for a while. If you've read ahead, if you know where this story is going, you know why this phrase is important. But it is a significant piece for the rest of this story. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be prince over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. And Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal, and the rest of the army went up after Saul to meet the army. And they went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin. Samuel says, look, all you had to do was obey. All you had to do was what God commanded you to do. Because you didn't, he's going to find someone who will. You'll find someone who thinks like him, someone who obeys him, someone who has a heart for God. You, Saul, are going to be replaced. And this, 2 years into his reign, is the beginning of the end for Saul. From this point forward, Saul goes from this point where he's at his peak to being nothing. And we're just going to see him degrade over time, because the Lord has chosen at this point a new king. At this point in the story, we don't know who that is yet. Again, if you've read ahead, you know. But at this point, all Saul knows is it's not him anymore. And the raiders came out of the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned towards Ophrah, the other the land Shuah, and another company towards Beth Horon, and another company turned towards the border that looks down on the valley of Zeboim toward the wilderness. The lands don't matter as much. We're not studying military history here, although it's fascinating if you do want to go study that. What's important here is they came and they broke into three different companies. They went out, a large number. They have enough people that they can divide into three full companies as they go into battle against Israel. And now there was no blacksmith to be found through all the land of Israel. For the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make themselves swords or spears. So on the day of the battle, there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people with Saul and Jonathan. But Saul and Jonathan, his son, had them. I kind of highlighted the important parts here. The section that I left out here in the middle is simply explaining some of the economical ramifications as to why the Israelites didn't have swords. The important thing is the Philistines decided they're not allowed to have swords. They got rid of all the blacksmiths. So the Israelites who were coming into battle didn't have swords. They didn't have spears. They didn't have an ability to actually go fight in this battle. The only people that seem to have swords, who seem to have spears, are Saul and his son Jonathan. So the king and the king's son have swords and spears. Everyone else has whatever they brought to battle with them. That's not going to win the day. That's not going to go well for them. When only the two people on the front of the line have the weapons, the rest of the people are looking down the barrel of danger. Not good things. But Jonathan says to the young man who carries his armor bearer, come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few. And his armor bearer said to him, do all that is in your heart, do as you wish. Behold, I am with you, your heart and soul. I had a little trouble in this one trying to decide which words I wanted to put in purple, which ones I wanted to focus on, because the author is probably actually trying to highlight this phrase, saving by many or by few. What Jonathan is saying to his armor bearer is, it doesn't matter if there's two of us or 2 million of us, if God is on our side, whatever he desires will be the outcome. If God is going to save Israel, he does not need numbers to do it. It's literally the exact opposite mentality that just got his father into trouble. His father was like, I'm losing my army. I need to disobey in order to win. What Jonathan is saying is, no, even if it's just two of us, if God is with us, we can win this day. I highlighted this secondary part because I think it's a really interesting response from his armor bearer. Through this section, I've been noticing this phrase keeps getting used. Do all that is in your heart. We've seen it said to Samuel or to Saul already. We're going to see it said to Saul again a couple of times here in the rest of this chapter. But this is the only time where it seems to go well for the person it's being told to. Because his armor bearer says to him, do all that is in your heart. Do as you wish. Behold, I am with you in heart and soul. And I think it's that secondary part that makes this time different. The armor bearer is hearing what Jonathan is saying and actually agrees with it. And actually says, yes, this is a right mentality. And what he says to Jonathan is, Jonathan, I've got your back. As you ride into battle, I'm going with you and I've got your back. We will do this because you have chosen to stand for the Lord. I am with you. And my encouragement to you at this point, I didn't put it as one of my so what questions because it's not one of the main points of this passage. But my encouragement to you right here is you need an armor bearer and you need to be an armor bearer. Again, armor bearers are going to play a role in the rest of this story, but in this specific instance, what it is he is looking at Jonathan and saying, because you've chosen to stand for God, because you have chosen obedience, and because you are going to battle for God, I am with you. I am very, very blessed that in this church, I don't just have one. I have a number of armor bearers who come alongside of me and tell me things like, hey, I think this is for God. I am with you. I've got your back. I've got people in this church who have expressed that they are with me. I am grateful that they are also the kinds of people that when I'm making the Saul decisions are willing to say, yeah, I'm still with you, but that's a bad idea. You don't want to be doing that. You need an armor bearer in your life, someone who can look to you and say, yes, the thing you are doing is for God. I've got your back. Or no, the thing you're doing is not for God. We need to take a step back. You need someone who can speak that honestly into your life, and you need to be that for someone as well. And that can be just as hard. Hearing and giving can be just as hard, but we need to be this for each other in our lives. We were not meant to do life alone. You need someone in your life who can do this for you. All right, soapbox over. Anyway, then Jonathan said, behold, we will cross over to the men, and we will show ourselves to them. And if they say to us, wait until we come down to you, or wait until we come to you, then we will stand still in our place, and we will not go up to them. But if they say, come up to us, then we will go up, for the Lord has given them into our hand. And this shall be a sign to us. What he's saying is, okay, armor bearer, it's you and me. We're going into this alone. We've got a cliff in front of us. They're up there. We're down here. This is not a good place to be fighting a hand-to-hand battle. This is not how we'd prefer it to be, but we've got God on our side. So here's the sign. If they say to come up, we'll go up. If they say they're going to come down, we'll wait for them to come down. I think it's interesting that John's like, either way, we're fighting these dudes. But this will be a sign from God that we are going to win. If they call us to come up to them, we'll go up to them. So they do. So they both showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines, and the Philistines said, look, Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden themselves. They're going to stop being cowards. They're coming to fight. And the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us, and we will show you a thing. And Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come up after me. The Lord has given them into the hand of Israel. Because they have called us to make the worst strategic decision we could possibly make, this is a sign that God is going to allow us to win the day. Logic out the window. We are going to climb this cliff to the guys who are waiting at the top. This is absolutely the scene out of Princess Bride. Like, they could cut the rope, dead. They could throw a rock, dead. They could wait till they get to the top and they're winded, dead. But this is Jonathan's sign that God is with him. This is how he knows he's going to win. So they climb up. And Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet, and the armor bearer after him. And they fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer killed them after him. And that first strike, which Jonathan and his armor bearer made, killed about 20 men within as it were half a furrow's length in an acre of land. I did not have that much trouble reading that earlier. All right. But the idea here is, okay, so they get to the top, and Jonathan just immediately goes into beast mode. He's going through, and it seems like he's got a sword, and his armor bearer was given the spear that he had, so they're sharing these weapons, or the other way around, I'm not sure. But Jonathan's going in, and he's just slicing people, just cutting them down. And as they're laying on the ground, I told you, Old Testament, it does not stay G-rated. His armor bearer is coming along, just one, two, three, finishing them off. As Jonathan takes the first strike, armor bearer takes strike number two, and 20 men die at the hand of Jonathan and his armor bearer. This is the first victory in what is going to turn into a very, very bloody battle. It says, and there was panic in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison and even the raiders trembled. The earth quaked, and it became a very great panic. And the watchmen of Saul and Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude was dispersing here and there. They go to battle. The two of them kill 20. And then God says, all right, let's make this happen. Everyone gets terrified. There's an earthquake. Everybody's panicking and dispersing. And Saul looks up from where he's at because he has his own garrison that has not gone to battle and gone, what in the world's going on over there? They're all running like they're at war, and my people they're all still here. What is going on? And Saul says to the people who are with him, count and see who has gone from us. Who went up there without us? And when they counted, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. Two people. And Saul says to Ahijah, no idea, bring the ark of God here, for the ark of God went at that time with the people of Israel. Saul's looking around. He's like, who is going to battle? Two people. Two people have gone to battle. And Saul goes, oh my, this is not good. These two people have gone up. My son has gone up to war without his men. This isn't good. Bring the ark of God here. This seems to be hearkening back to the earlier passage where the people of Israel were viewing the ark as this supernatural talisman, this superstitious item who was going to bring them victory. And he's like, oh man, we need this ark here quick because my son's out there doing battle alone. Bring the good luck charm. And because at this time that just went everywhere with them. And now while Saul was talking to the priests, the tumult in the camp of the Philistines increased more and more. It got worse and worse to the point that Saul says to the priest, withdraw your hand. And then Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and went into battle. And behold, every Philistine sword was against his fellow. And there was very great confusion. Jonathan listens to God, obeys, goes to battle, and the two of them end up doing such incredible work that when Saul looks up and sees the chaos that these two men are causing in the enemy camp, as they are panicking, as they start to kill each other, and God shows up giving a victory, Saul goes from, bring me my good luck charm, to, actually, never mind, we don't need that, in an instant. And he's like, all right, we don't need it. We'll just go take care of this. So I was like, oh, never mind, priest. I got this. I don't need you anyway. But behold, every Philistine sword was against his fellow. And the Hebrews who had been with the Philistines before that time, who had gone up with them into the camp, even they also turned to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, when all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines were fleeing, they too followed hard after seeing them in battle. The ones who hid are coming out to battle. The ones who had joined the other side were coming back to Israel, and everybody was showing up because of what was happening. So the Lord saved Israel that day. And the battle passed beyond Beth Aven. The Lord saved Israel that day, while Saul sat on the sideline. While Saul didn't even join in the battle, the two men, Jonathan and his armor bearer, obeyed God, went to battle, and the Lord saves Israel on that day. And the men of Israel had been hard-pressed that day. So Saul had laid an oath on the people, saying, "Cursed be the man who eats food until it is evening, and I am avenged on my enemies." So none of the people had tasted food. So the author here takes a step back and says, while this was all going on, Saul had actually been pushing his men too hard. And as a result, they were hungry. But Saul says to them, "No, no food until we win the battle. No food until we win." So none of the people in his camp had tasted food. But when all the people came to the forest, behold, there was honey on the ground. And when the people entered the forest, behold, the honey was dropping, but no one put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. They feared that Saul would punish them. They feared that his oath, his promise to punish anyone who ate, would cause them to die. But Jonathan, you know, the guy who was out fighting the battle with his armor bearer, the one who was actually doing what he was called to do, he had not heard his father's charge, the people with the oath. So he put out the tip of his staff that was in his hand, dipped it in the honeycomb, and put his hand to his mouth, and his eyes became bright. Then one of the people said, "Your father strictly charged the people with an oath, saying, 'Cursed be the man who eats food this day.'" And the people were faint. The idea here is that Jonathan was also hungry, but he didn't hear the oath. He wasn't scared of the oath. So he ate the honey, and his eyes became bright. It basically means he stopped being famished. He stopped being faint. All of a sudden, he had the strength to go to battle because he ate food, specifically honey, which apparently is like one of the healthiest things you can eat on the planet. But like, this was a good thing, and it helped him as he went in to battle. But the people, Saul's people, were faint. Then Jonathan said, "My father has troubled the land. See how my eyes have become bright because I tasted a little bit of this honey? How much better if the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies that they had found? For now the defeat amongst the Philistines has not been great." What Jonathan is saying is, why is my father so obsessed with his oath when all he had to do was feed his people? God had provided honey. God had provided the spoils of battle. God had provided food. And Saul thought his superstition could save him better than his God. And as a result, it says, because he was trusting himself and not his God, the defeat was not that great. They won, but Jonathan's saying, we could have won so much more today. The defeat could have been so much greater than what it was had my father just let the people eat what God had provided. So they struck down the Philistines that day from Michmash to, no idea, and the people were very faint. And the people pounced on the spoil and took sheep and oxen and calves and slaughtered them on the ground, and the people ate them with the blood. And then they told Saul, "Behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood." So when they finally do get the victory, when they're finally allowed to eat, they eat with such greed and such overwhelming necessity that they actually eat against the dietary laws of Israel. Their faintness, their exhaustion, the absolute scraping the bottom of the barrel nature with which Saul had run them ragged, their exhaustion actually led them to sin. Their exhaustion caused them to make poor decisions. And Saul owned it and said, "I've been a bad leader. I ran. This is my fault. This is not their fault. That this is on me, God." Right? No. He said, "You have dealt treacherously. You did badly, so roll a great stone here to me." And Saul says, "Disperse yourself amongst the people and say to them, 'Let every man bring his ox and his sheep,' and he slaughtered them here and eat. And do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood." So that every one of the people brought his ox to him that night, and they slaughtered them there. Saul says, "Look, you messed up, so we're going to punish you for it. It has nothing to do with me. I'm the hero of this story. And so we're going to kill your ox. We're going to kill your sheep. Just stop doing this sin thing that I did first and better and more." All right. Then Saul built the altar to the Lord, and it was the first altar he built to the Lord 2 years after he became king. The idea is this is the first time that he has spent the time investing to build an altar to the Lord. It's not a good thing. And Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them until the morning light. Let us not leave a man to them." And they said, "Do whatever seems good to you." But the priest says, "Let us draw near to God here." The people hear Saul's plan to go to battle, and they say, yeah, whatever, do whatever seems good to you. We'll just follow you. You're our king. The priests are going, wait, no, there's this thing we need to do first. It's this whole going to God thing, making sure that he wants us to do the thing, making sure that we're following what he wants us to do. So Saul inquired of God, shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into the hand of Israel? But he did not answer him that day. God doesn't answer him. And Saul says, come here, all you leaders of the people, and know and see how this sin has arisen today. For as the Lord lives who saves Israel, though it be in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die. What he's saying is God is not answering us anymore. Somebody has sinned. Somebody has messed up. Somebody has gotten this wrong. Because God is not answering. We're going to figure out who it is. And even if it's my son, Jonathan, we're going to put that person to death. I know it's not my son, Jonathan. I know it's not me. But whoever it is, even if it's in my son, we're going to put him to death. But there was not a man among all the people who answered him. And then he said to all Israel, you shall be on one side, and I and Jonathan, my son, will be on the other side. And the people said to Saul, do what seems good to you. You're the king. We're going to follow you. And therefore Saul said, oh, Lord of God of Israel, why have you not answered your servant this day? If the guilt is in me or in Jonathan, my son, O Lord God of Israel, give Urim. But if the guilt is on your people Israel, give Thummim. And Jonathan and Saul were taken, but the people escaped. And Saul said, cast the lot between me and my son Jonathan. And Jonathan was taken. So the Urim and the Thummim, these are the tools that they would have used to seek God's will at this period of time. It's casting lots. It would be similar to like rolling a dice or flipping a coin. It's whatever side it comes up on, whether it's odd or even, or whether it's heads or tails, tells you what to do. So they would start with a large group, whittle it down from there. So he starts with me and my son Jonathan, everybody else. Expecting it's going to be everybody else. It's not. It's just the two of them. So they only have to roll one more time, and sure enough, it's Jonathan. Comes up to Jonathan, and Saul says to Jonathan, tell me, what have you done? What did you sin? How did you sin? And Jonathan tells him, well, I had some honey on the top of my staff. It was in my hand. Here I am. If that's the thing, I will die. If that's the thing that pronounces my death, I'll die. And Saul said, God do to me and more, you shall surely die, Jonathan. Saul gets it in his brain. Yep, he ate. When I said he shouldn't eat, my oath, now he's got to die. But the people, I think rightfully so, look at him and go, wait, shall Jonathan die? Who has worked this great salvation in Israel? Far from it. As the Lord lives, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So the people ransomed Jonathan so that he did not die. Then Saul went up from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. The people rightfully look at the situation and go, no, Saul, that's not how this is going to work. All the way they've been saying, do what is right to you, do what is right to you. We will follow you. Do what is right to you. We'll follow you. Do it. And as soon as he turns to Jonathan, they go, wait. He's the only one who's been actually hearing God today and following God's will today. You're the one who's been off chasing superstitions and doing whatever the heck you wanted all day. We'll follow you because you're our king, but you're not touching Jonathan. And God uses the people to stand against their king, to ransom, to save Jonathan. And when Saul had taken the kingship over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the Ammonites, against Edom, against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines, and wherever he turned, he routed them. And he did valiantly and struck the Amalekites, delivered Israel out of the hands of those who plundered them. God gave Saul many great victories. But what we are seeing from these two chapters is that Saul keeps choosing himself and keeps taking himself down level after level in the eyes of God and the eyes of his people. So what does that mean for us? Well, first, we have to keep in mind and we have to always remember we are not the hero of the story. It is so easy for me, and I think for us, to get it in our heads that if I don't do it, no one will do it. If I don't do it, because I'm the important one, because I'm the one who is capable, because I am the one, no one will do it, and it won't get done. I'm telling you, if God wants it to be done, it will be done whether you do it or not. And if God doesn't want it done, and you're insisting on doing it, watch out. Because if God doesn't want it done, it ain't going to get done. Even if he's got to take you out to make sure that it doesn't get done. We are not the hero of the story. He is. God is always the hero of the story, not us. If we insist on being the hero of the story, he will remind us that we are not the hero of the story. He will make sure we know. But when we, like Jonathan, submit ourselves to him, to obeying him and following him and the things he has commanded us to do, that's when he shows up. And so often we end up looking good, not because of anything we've done, but because of what he's done on our behalf. Two men did not conquer the Philistine army. The Lord delivered Israel that day. Jonathan, though, is the one who garnered the favor of the people because he showed up and did what his God called him to do. Pride goes before destruction. Pride is the thing that takes Saul out at the knees, thinking that he is the one when it should have been about God the whole time. Thinking that he was so important is the thing that ends up losing him his kingdom. 2 years. 2 years he ruled before pride finally takes him out. But prayer is the thing that goes before victory. Because at the end of the day, it does not matter what I think is important. It matters what God thinks is important. It does not matter what I think is best for this church. I am called as pastor to lead the church. I am called and I am giving an account and I am responsible. But you know what? It does not matter what I think is good for this church. What matters is what God thinks is good for this church. And any time that I line up as a leader with what God is calling us to do, God will show up because he's the hero of the story. And any time I decide my way is better, that's not going to go well. But the same is true in each and every one of our lives. When we choose what we think is best rather than what God thinks is best, we can get so confused into thinking that it's all about us. Which is why we need to kill pride everywhere we find it in our lives and instead turn to prayer and saying, God, I want you to oppose me when I am wrong. And I want you to make it clear to me what you want so that I can obey. Submit, obey, and trust you to be the one who shows up. Let's pray. God, when I am thinking rightly, I am glad I am not in charge. I am glad that it is about you and that you have not called me to be the hero because we would all be doomed. God, I pray that as we seek your face, that you will continue to make yourself clear, that you'll make your will for us known, and that we could just fall deeply in love with you as we watch you show up again and again to establish your kingdom as you make yourself great. Let us celebrate that with you. In your son's name, amen.